So welcome to this Vistage meeting. I'm very excited to be able to feature one of our trusted advisors, Scott Rood, and his company, Vital Tech, in this presentation. And I know personally that as people have evolved to working remotely, there's really so many new risks and concerns that people should have as it relates to protecting their assets, their data, as we think about what's happening in terms of the remote workplace. And so to kick off the session, I'd really like everyone just to introduce themselves, just tell your name and your company, and you may be in a position that you have a specific IT concern, whether it's security or something else. You may have a very specific concern that keeps you awake at night, or maybe you don't have anything that is top of mind. But as we go around the room, I'll just call on folks so that we can stay in a consistent order. If you just introduce yourself and your name, and then again, give us one or two words that describe your security risk. So we'll actually start with our guest, if you don't mind, Chris. Please introduce yourself to everyone who's on the call.
Sure, yeah. Chris Vysotchnik, work for Great Lakes Credit Union. I'm the Vice President of IT. And really, the largest concern that I have and really always have and have had in financial services is just information security. So then everything that goes around that, you know, it's a very broad and deep subject. So that's what concerns me the most.
Great. Thanks, Chris. Matt.
Yeah, Matt McKnight. I'm president and founder of McKnight Advisors. We're a sales consulting company. And my concerns are not as deep and wide as Chris's are by any means. But just real quick, I mean, a lot of times I have clients, whether they're private equity clients, and I have to use the virtual data room. We go in there with very sensitive financials. I have a current client who's in the financial services area as well. You know, and I'm on an Apple laptop, right? You know, and I have another Apple, but, you know, they set me up with like Microsoft Remote Desktop, right? And use ESET like security. They had me download all these different tools to scan my laptop, which is fairly common. So I just give you that for a little color commentary.
Thanks so much, Matt. Jim.
Jim Miles, Insperity, Business Performance Advisor. I work with small and mid-sized companies for outsourced HR benefits, compliance, everything like that. So very relevant for times like this to help these small businesses recover from what we're going on. But yeah, I mean, we're a 3,500 person company and excited to hear what Scott has to say.
Excellent. Thank you so much. If other people join us, I will have them briefly introduce themselves at the end. I will mention that we're recording this session so that I can send it out to everyone in the group. So keep that in mind as we're discussing the topics. With that, I'm going to actually turn it over to Scott and Sean, who will introduce themselves more specifically.
Thank you, Sue. All right. Just so you have a heads up with the smaller group than anticipated, please, we will encourage you to pipe in with questions as they spark to your mind. This is targeted more to a CEO level. So Chris, this might sound like kindergarten to you for portions of this, but Sean will handle much of the technical elements of it, and I'll try to give us more high level as in terms of polling and statistics throughout that. So as you can see from the title, protecting your company from cyber threats amid COVID-19 and beyond. This is something that I don't think we anticipated, fair to say, going into the year, but tech is always something very relevant for companies in terms of safety and security, big, medium, or small in terms of the size of your company. According to CIO.com, 81% of companies had the intention in December of 2019 to boost their tech budget for the calendar year. As you'll see, already 40% have reduced it, which is not to say that everybody is that way, but we'll get into those numbers. Thank you for joining us. In terms of Sean and I, we want to introduce ourselves. So I'll first yield to co-founder Sean Vitale. Sean.
Hey everyone, thanks again for joining us. Yeah, Chris, I can dig in on the technical stuff if you want to, so that we don't bore everybody else. Feel free to just reach out to me. You can get my contact info from Sue, and we can geek out if you want to. More than happy to. So I'm Sean Vitale, co-founder of Vital Tech. I'm also a Vistage member. I have been for 2 years. I'm part of a key group. I love Vistage myself, to be honest. I love the relationships that I've developed with Vistage. I love the soundboard. I love the accountability. I could go on and on and on, but I'm a big advocate for Vistage in general. I started the company 11 years ago, Vital Tech, with my business partner, Mike Burke. My professional career has always been in technology. I started as a systems administrator for a law firm called Levenfeld Perlstein. After a few years of working with Levenfeld, I decided I wanted to get into the consulting side of things, so I signed up with a small firm. We worked heavy on the enterprise level space, did some VoIP implementations for companies like Blue Cross Blue Shield, ABN AMRO, and Quaker, things like that. While I was working at that consulting company, attorneys from Levenfeld contacted me and basically were starting their own business or partnering with somebody who was starting their own business. And they needed help with their IT. They needed guidance. They needed setup and all that. So I brought them in as clients to that consulting company. And that was my first sort of dip into the small business world and supporting small businesses in IT. I've supported enterprise level businesses, and I'd supported, and I call it, you know, Levenfeld, a medium sized business. But that was my first experience with it. So what I noticed there was from between working at Levenfeld and working with enterprise level clients, I just noticed a lack of the way that IT environments were ran. And right at that time, I wrote a business plan with my business partner, who's my now business partner, Mike Burke, presented it to the owner. Obviously things didn't work out, and one thing led to another. We founded Vital Tech. So today I'm responsible for all of client experience. So anything that's client facing, whether it's support, whether it's recommendations, whether it's maintenance, all of it, I'm totally responsible for the whole thing. I spend a lot of my time in front of clients, making recommendations, providing guidance, working through issues and answering any of their questions at a very, very high level.
And I'm Scott Rood. I run partnerships and trying to grow business. I'm talking to a lot of C-level people throughout the Chicagoland areas. We're trying to grow, most of all during the pandemic. My approach is different with a lot of calling, LinkedIn. But my career kind of took a 180 for my first 13 years out of college. I was a sports broadcaster, and now I've switched over. I think the biggest reason was because of Sean and Mike. I knew Mike previously, and I really have a lot of faith and belief in the character and the vision that Sean and Mike have for Vital Tech. I believe in the product. I believe in our services. I certainly believe in our people. And our tech experts make up 90% of our staff. And it's very easy to market and brand and advocate when I really believe in the ethos and the morality of what Vital Tech stands for. Sean?
You guys want to hear some really crazy Tiger Woods stories? Hit up Scott afterwards.
Sure.
You can tell him the elevator story. It's a pretty good one. So what do we want to accomplish today? Before we begin, let's just talk about what cybersecurity is. Don't hold me accountable for this if you think it's inaccurate. Chris, you're just adding a little bit of pressure here. We define cybersecurity as implementing solutions that will prevent hackers from accessing, changing, destroying, or extorting digital information. Basically, there's these malicious people out there, right? They want access to your data, they want access to your systems, and they want to just do malicious things. We don't know why. I personally think they should be trying to cure cancer or more right now, at least COVID, but they're not. So what do we want to talk about today? Well, we're going to talk about cybersecurity. We're going to sprinkle in how things relate into with the current situation, the pandemic that we're in. But there's four risks that I like to talk about. These are just the more prominent ones that are associated. These are the different avenues that the cyber criminals take So what we're going to do is we're going to talk about the risks the risk of those different avenues, and then we're going to talk about how to prevent those risks from actually accessing your environment, or the cyber criminals, I should say, from accessing your environment. And then, since we're dealing with the pandemic right now, I think it's important for us to talk about, with any presentation, just what will be the new normal. Maybe with IT, maybe not with IT. Just last week I was meeting with my business partner and we were talking about opening the new office back up. So I think just in lieu of everything going on, it's important for us to spend some time on there. At the end of each section, we have a slotted slide for questions, but with a group this small, you guys, honestly, you don't even have to mute yourself. Chime in, ask questions. I'll pause still if you guys have any at the end, just in case you prefer to let me keep going. But no matter what I'm saying, honestly, just feel free to cut me off and ask a question. This can be super interactive. And by the way, just so you guys know, I'm looking up at my screens. My camera is right here. So if you see me looking up, it's because I'm looking at the presentation and now I'm looking at the notes.
All right, so I'm going to give you some facts. And as far as interactivity, which Sean alluded to, we will require you guys to pop on a URL, albeit a phone, tablet, likely your computer. We have 5 polls throughout this presentation to get an idea. Now, granted, they're anonymous, but when we have such a small sample, we'll start getting an idea where it fits. It'll be sort of tongue-in-cheek to a degree. Key facts here. These are more in general. These wouldn't have changed this slide in terms of these numbers with or without COVID heading into the 2020 calendar year. As you can see, 81% of organizations claim the negligent or careless us were the reason for why data breaches or cyber attacks occur. Of them, 90% come from emails. They feel these hackers think like a thief a little bit while we're in this presentation. They see email as the best portal for them to gather information, attack our vulnerabilities. 2 in 5 workers, 40%, admit to clicking on or opening an attachment from a sender they don't recognize. And once it's happened after the fact, it's too late. 54% of companies say that they've experienced an instance of ransomware, which Sean will address directly, where they hold your data for a number of reasons, most notably money. The majority of companies, big or small, had an incident in 2019. Obviously, applications are significant, right? Because we use them on our phones, tablets, computers, and thieves, hackers, malicious people from a cyber sense, they want to go where people are, where clicks are, where traffic is, where we're most vulnerable. In 2019, over 3 million apps were considered to be basically vessels for malware. And how does this all result? With or without the pandemic, 2021, the projections are that over $6 trillion will be estimated of annual costs that will be the result in terms of cyber crime, whether it's data or just money through ransomware. Now, how does this pertain to it from cybersecurity? Let's talk from a social standpoint, right? This might be pretty self-explanatory. Here's the transition as we've all been working remotely. Employees more comfortable at home, they're more likely to click and validate, right? As we allude to with phishing being the most common practice for thieves to acquire data. Employees work more often now on their personal computers. It's a roughly around 50% right now, believe it or not. Employees now just can't pop over to the cubicle or the office for confirmation from their colleagues or supervisors. What that does is if they're not going to get some type of instantaneous response, they may just rely more on their intuition or instinctiveness, where they'll just say, I'll click on it. We'll see what happens. And this is obviously significant. I mean, obviously H1N1, SARS, there is some precedent in terms of viruses or pandemics, albeit we were not that dependent or, on our phones every second and sharing our data or relying on the digital environment as much back then, so much is far more magnified. But the FBI, within the first week, sensing shutdowns in late March, on their website, it's still right on the front page, their release was scammers are leveraging the COVID-19 pandemic to steal your personal information, or and don't let them. This is obviously something that's incredible important for them in terms of law enforcement and stopping crimes. It's not really rocket science. They want to tack into what's most vulnerable, what's sensitive. So the things that people were most stressed out about, it might be a little more on edge to click towards: fake stimulus checks, fake vaccines, fake testing kits. Now, some statistics before Sean takes over to scare you more. $24 million so far in just COVID-related cyber scams. 46% of Americans have been targeted with COVID-related cyber scams. 32% of them, of these respondents, have received them through phishing emails. And by the way, as you can see, this data is from CensusWide. CensusWide's likely, in my opinion, the most reputable independent research study firm for tech industries. This just came out a week ago from today on May 6th. 40%, and as you can imagine, because of the tight window, there haven't been that many comprehensive studies released. 40% of companies have reduced cybersecurity costs since March 15th. That has much to do, or entirely to do, with loss of revenue. And 50% of companies have allowed employees to conduct work using their personal computers, a huge no-no, which Sean will highlight more. And 43% of respondents right now don't feel their web applications that they're using are secure enough. Sean?
Perfect. So we talked about the different avenues, or I referenced earlier the different avenues that these malicious attackers are going to take. And the four that I like to talk about are email. Everyone's aware, you know, based on Scott's last statistic, 90% of all cyber attacks start with email. So that's an important one, not to neglect. We're going to talk about devices and data, so how they access your devices, the risks associated with accessing your devices, and the data that sits on them. We're going to talk about passwords and personal information. So when they access your data, how they access your passwords, what they're doing with your personal information, obviously some ways to prevent that. And then lastly, we're going to talk about ransomware, which Scott kind of brought up some statistics on there. It's still prominent. It's not as prominent as it once was, but I do think it's important since it sort of initiated, I'll call it the revenue of all of these, you know, cyber criminals. I mean, you know, you look at that $1 trillion industry that it's created right now. That's just nuts. What other industries does that compare with? It's crazy.
All right. So we'll start with email and a poll. This is in the form of communication. Sue's going to pull up our first poll. It has to do with communication tools, which I find interesting. We're a huge advocate for Teams, which is under the Microsoft team. And as you can see, question poll one, please answer, does your organization readily use a communication tool like Microsoft Teams or Slack? Your options: yes, we use tools before COVID-19. Yes, we implemented since COVID-19. Or no. Once you submit that, give Sue a second.
And here are the results.
So for four or five of us, Sean, we're using Teams beforehand. Does anybody that's out there want to talk about how they use Teams or Slack and what they use it for, and has it been more effective or different since we've been distributed working?
I could chime in real quick. We don't use Teams specifically. We use WebEx and Cisco's Jabber product, but they're, I would classify them as kind of in the same boat as Teams as far as communication, if that's what you're getting at, unless I read that wrong.
Yeah, no. And it's funny that you see this email slide. We've put together, and we at VitalTech, we create content. We've done one on communication tools, and the title is Say Goodbye to Email, with the idea that once everybody jumps on board with this integration and platform for communication, we could see certainly within the decade of email being from a business standpoint, and even from a personal standpoint, decently obsolete?
I think it's important to bring up, and the reason why is, especially during this pandemic, you know, Scott alluded to, people are more comfortable at home. They're going to click things. They're going to open things. At least when you're in the office, they could kind of turn their head and ask the person next to them in the cubicle, or go to a nearby office and talk to somebody and just get their opinion on whether or not they should click, or if that person receives it themselves, and at least create a dialogue. And if you're not using that messaging platform now with your employees, that you think about it, that communication completely went away. So it makes you a little more susceptible, makes your business, it creates a higher risk for your business. And we think it's important to have a communication tool like Teams or Slack or Jabber, so that you can replace that communication that once was when people were in the office.
Does anyone else have further comments or questions while we're addressing such communication tools? Alrighty, we'll continue. Sean.
So let's dig into email and the risks associated with it. So here are the risks, and everything basically is in one way or another related to downtime for the business, right? That's what these malicious hackers are doing. They're trying to create downtime for your business, and in some way, shape, or form, make money off of that. Impersonation is probably one of the more prominent ones nowadays. Everybody gets impersonation emails. If you haven't, you definitely will, I would say, within the next week. Although I'd be surprised if you haven't. And the impersonation can be anywhere from anyone in your company, maybe one of the clients or the customers you work with, a vendor you work with. Businesses can be impersonated. You know, everybody's probably got the UPS email where it's asking you to click an attachment, or an email from, you know, Microsoft 365 or Google saying, hey, your mailbox is running out of storage. Click here to log in and add more storage. So that's a risk. That's one of the risks associated with email. Sometimes in those emails, you'll have the false URLs. So a URL that's either redirecting you to obtain your credentials or redirecting you to download something malicious to your computer. That's obviously a risk, because if you click on any of those, bad things happen. I referenced this just briefly before. So obtaining your credentials is a risk, either by clicking emails or impersonating and just flat out asking for credentials. Your credentials basically can be exposed by not just at least being aware of what types of emails are out there. Hopefully no one's experienced this personally. I definitely have had a few clients, but I keep seeing this, so I always think it's kind of a fun topic to bring up. Buying gift cards, this usually starts with a controller or a CEO or a CFO saying, hey, I have an important project. Can you please contact me as soon as possible, kind of thing. And then a dialogue begins, and it usually lands down a road where you're buying Amazon gift cards or Walmart gift cards, things like that. One thing to keep in mind with all of this is your reputation can actually be damaged. So if your business is down, if you're clicking something, if your data, you know, we'll talk about data being encrypted or inaccessible, or let's say your credentials are hacked and someone hacks into your contact list and sends an email out to everyone in your contact list with a fake attachment, with a false URL. Now you actually have to go back to those people and tell them, hey, I'm sorry. There was a breach of security in my environment. Please don't click the link. And then you might have to do some explaining, especially if you're in the financial industry and you have PCI compliance or all kinds of sorts of compliances. You know, that's just never a good situation for you. So your business as a whole, the reputation can be damaged. So how do you prevent these from entering your environment? What are the solutions to email threats? First and foremost is user awareness. So just making the users aware of the different types of emails and threats that are out there. What does an impersonation email look like? How can you identify it? What does a false URL look like? How do you validate emails just in general? There's a couple solutions we like. One's Bullfish, another one's KnowBefore, and another one's Mimecast. What these do is you can select targeted email campaigns. They're ethical email campaigns. So if you're in the financial industry, you can just send out, hey, it's Chase Bank, I'm trying to log in. and identify which users are actually clicking those. And then these types of systems will actually identify who clicked it, and it can send out training videos later on for them. You can stop these emails in the first place from you ever entering your environment by implementing an advanced spam filtering solution. We like Microsoft Advanced Threat Protection, Mimecast, and Trustify for all of those, but basically each one of them has their own algorithm to identify the different types of breaches through email. So ways to identify impersonation, ways to identify attachments or false URLs, and either quarantine or prevent them from ever entering your environment.
Questions specifically to the cyber threats, attacks, and prevention for email?
Yeah, it's Matt. You know, I started by just making, you know, Sue, you asked me about myself, but actually equally important. I really am on here also because of my customers, right? So Sean or Scott, maybe you could weigh in on like what's, when you say small to medium sized customers, how big? And then I have a specific use case maybe you can address, because I'm just sort of curious to build my own narrative. But SBA, you know, PPP is big topic right now, right? A lot of that's being done by email, right? And I've been on enough SBA webinars with the government, Chamber of Commerce and others, where this comes up and they all flag like, don't, you know, click on anything, you know, blah, blah, blah. But they never offer any solutions. They just, you know, basically present the problem, right? And I have clients, obviously, that have gotten PPP money and others, but I'm just curious, you know, if you run across that problem, and also back to my broader question, how big is your, you know, your ideal customer profile?
It's funny. A while ago, our ideal customer was like, you know, 5 to 50. And now our smallest customer, Scott might know more than me, it's somewhere around 5, and our largest customer is somewhere around 700. Yes. You know, if you ask Sue, she might talk in terms of revenue or sales based on the business. We deal in size because, you know, the number of computers is what we support. But we have clients, most of them, almost all of them are headquartered in and around Chicago, and they have offices all over the United States. So hopefully that answers your question, yeah, at least on that.
Thank you.
Yeah, size of businesses. As far as SBA, we're starting to see some campaigns, especially now when people were so anxious to get the PPP money. They were so anxious to deal with their applications. There were a ton of emails that were going out related to this. The best way to address it really is to just verbally validate with the banker, or make sure that you have a solution in place that is identifying these emails and make, you know, to block them or quarantine them. I'm not quite sure I was answering the SBA question.
I think so. I think, I mean, some of the solutions just outlined in the previous slide would probably catch. You can't obviously claim all of them, but a majority of those kind of like, you know, attempts.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, they would. For the most part, it's going to be, it's probably going to be a false URL. So click here, log into the bank kind of thing, right? Finish the form for your PPP application. That's a false URL. It's going to, the next website it takes you to is going to look like chase.com or any other bank.com. And it's the first thing you type in on those is your credentials to log in. So the username and password. So what a lot of solutions do, and it can be sort of a hindrance because sometimes it takes you to another website and says, are you sure you want to click this link? Are you sure it's a trusted source? And then once you click that link, the solution itself rescans the email and looks to see if it's actually chase.com or whatever bank.com to validate that link. Otherwise, you know, users might click it and just kind of move on.
Great. Thank you.
Yeah.
Anyone else? All right, we have more time and more topics for you to pipe in. Cyber threats to your devices. We're going to do a poll really quick before Sean starts giving us intel in terms of their threats and prevention tactics. The question is, are your employees working on a personal, non-company computer? How often, if at all? Options: regularly, sometimes, never. We'll let everybody submit. Interesting. Sean, thoughts on seeing the majority of people saying sometimes?
Sorry, my phone kind of keeps blowing up here. This is important to talk about, especially as we talk through who's accessing the devices and the attacks on those devices. If you think about it, you know, sometimes or regularly, never is the best. Businesses should almost always, if someone's accessing your IT system or the data from your IT system, it should be on a company-owned laptop. If they're not, then it's really hard to apply policies. It's really hard to implement software on those machines and prevent, you know, a lot of these cybersecurity threats from happening. So if you think about it, especially during a pandemic, and I know this is kind of hard because you'd have to ship everybody home laptops and things like that. What you really want to do is you just want to at least redirect them to a system. There's things like Citrix and other remote access virtual desktop solutions, or redirect them at least to a computer within the office to access that data so that you can apply policies and just prevent that data from existing anywhere else. Because the last thing you want is PII information, financial information, anything at all that might expose you, especially if you have to adhere to compliance sitting on those devices.
All right, let's get to the devices and starting, Sean, with risks.
So the risk associated with having your devices is data encryption. And we'll talk a lot more about this during ransomware. But the data that sits on those devices, that sits on the servers, that's in the environment, that data can be encrypted. And at that point, it's pretty much unusable. And if you can't access the data, you can't work, right? So you just want to make sure that you're aware of that risk. The other risk is data corruption. So you can, instead of it actually being encrypted, it's corrupted, also not usable, and therefore no one can access it. A little more severe, because at least with encryption, we don't recommend it. There's the chance of being able to decrypt the data. Application corruption. So I'll give a quick story on this, but the applications that access the data themselves, you can actually, they can actually become corrupt themselves or redirected. So we had a firm that has a document management solution. So they access all of their documents through a web browser, and they basically contracted a virus. It spread throughout the environment. It was about 70 computers, and we had to spend the night cleaning the virus, which was a lot of fun. But because of that virus, no one could access any of their documents at all the entire night. System failure. So rather than just, you know, encrypting your data or corrupting it or, you know, messing with the applications that you guys run in your environment, they can actually shut things down. We'll talk a little bit more about this, but you know, once you get access to the environment, they can shut down your virtual environment. They can shut down your computers themselves. They can just totally lock things up for you. So how do you prevent these people, you know, malicious people from accessing your devices and your data? First and foremost, you just need to have a good antivirus solution. There's two different kinds of antivirus solutions nowadays. This is how I generalize them. So take it, I don't want to say take it with a grain of salt, but this is just kind of the way I like to talk about it. There's advanced antivirus solutions, which are more behavioral based. And then there's the traditional antivirus solutions, which are definition based. I'll dig into these just real quickly, but I won't get too technical, I promise. So the advanced antivirus is, as I mentioned, is behavioral based. It basically just looks at behaviors on the computer. If the computer is acting a certain way or doing things that are just abnormal, it's just going to block that activity, as opposed to a more traditional definition-based antivirus. So a company like ESET, a virus comes out, ESET creates a definition for the virus to block it and make it publicly available. The computers download that definition, and therefore they're protected. Another way that people contract viruses on their computers, especially nowadays being home, is they're clicking links. And if you think about, you know, this is always a huge problem, I think, with using personal computers. There's kids that are playing games, they're browsing who knows what website. And if you don't have control over what websites that are being accessed on those devices, it's going to be really hard, because quite frequently those devices, those websites themselves, have malware that you know, get installed on your computer just by simply accessing them and playing these games. So the next point here of prevention is really something for the office, but I do think it's important to bring up as people have at home. Make sure you have a business class firewall. There's a lot of business class firewalls, and by no means is this like the top list. We like Cisco, SonicWall, Fortinet, Palo Alto. There's a million different firewalls out there, but I think what's important here to kind of note is as users are working from home, just make sure they're not plugged directly into the modem and getting access right out to the internet. Even a consumer residential grade firewall that they can pick up at the local tech store like Best Buy or Micro Center. Just make sure that they have some kind of protection, but having a firewall in place to at least block the hackers from, you know, getting into the local area network is important. Last but not least, there's patches, right? All these applications have holes, Microsoft's operating systems, Mac's operating systems, Adobe, you name it. There's vulnerabilities that exist and they're being exploited on a weekly basis. So you wanna make sure that you're pushing out patches and security updates to those computers on a frequent basis, just to make sure you're covered and you're not vulnerable. And again, this is particularly hard if people are accessing the information or the data within your systems from their home computers or their personal computers. It may even be hard if you're telling people to take their laptops from the office home if you don't have a solution that can push out updates to those computers on a routine basis as well.
Questions specifically to the cyber risks and then the preventions for devices or anything else that's on your mind from what we've covered? We got more coming your way with another poll right now as we about to embark on the risks with passwords. This poll question, how does your organization store its data? Pretty straightforward here. Server, cloud, both. Four of five people, Sean, both.
Cool. So it really doesn't matter where your data is accessed. It's probably easier, I would say, if your data is accessed in the cloud for people to access it from any device. It could be a public device, like a computer library, or anywhere. There's risks associated with connecting the wireless networks there. I think the important point there is to just make sure that when, or just be aware that, you know, if you're accessing something in the cloud or something in the environment, that your personal information exists in multiple areas. And you want to make sure that the passwords or credentials that are used to access that data are protected, which in turn protects the personal information that's on there. So the first risk associated here is people can steal it. They can, you know, if they get access to your system, they can take that information and they can do whatever the heck they want with it. And we'll talk a little bit more about that in a second. The second risk is corporate espionage. It's, you know, pretty self-explanatory one. Another business could access your information, use that against your business, and possibly shut you down. If you think about once you obtain access to a system, whether it's your password, it would be your password if they obtain access to your system via your password. Now they're inside the network, right? I can promise you that, especially the security partner that we work with, they love this because as soon as they get inside the network, I forgot what the percentage is. It's really high. They get access, administrative access to the system. And they've done some fun stuff with some of our clients, all ethical, but changed some backgrounds on some people's computers. They can also lock down your system. So not only can they infect your system with some viruses, they can just completely shut it down. So you just want to make sure that personal information, the passwords themselves are locked down. So how do you prevent these passwords from being accessed? You start with just some simple password policies. You make sure that they're being changed on a routine basis. You make sure that they're complex. They're not really simple. So they have a string of characters. They have to include numbers and or letters. Active Directory is a really popular solution out there, but it doesn't matter whatever system they're accessing. Make sure that they enforce complex passwords and that they're changed. Everybody that logs in their bank pretty much nowadays uses multi-factor authentication. Implement the same thing. This is where when you log in, it sends a text message or you have to open an application and punch in some rotating number before you can access it. you want to make sure that that's happening to all of your important systems as well, and you can implement that with any solution nowadays. So I talked about what they do with this information, and there's this thing called the dark web. And the dark web is basically the black market for your data, for your passwords, for your credentials, for your personal information. So HIPAA information, social security numbers, credit cards, passwords themselves can be all accessed in bulk, retained in bulk, and then sold on the dark web. And you can use a solution, we like this solution called ID Agent, to actually identify when that information is being sold in the dark web so that you can take action. So for example, if your password's out there, I like ID Agent because it creates a ticket in our help desk system. We can reach out to the user and say, hey, is this your password? Yes or no? And if it is, then let's change it because somebody, you know, accessed it and they, it's being sold in the dark web.
It's unfortunate if they're brainiacs and they could be curing cancer, but they choose to steal our data. And we put together a pretty good podcast and webinar on that where Sean walks you through really the mind of a hacker, of a cyber thief, to get a better idea of what they're looking for, why they're doing it. Questions specifically to passwords and their threats and how to prevent it. Pretty straightforward, right?
Yeah, I'll try and pick up the pace here so we can be conscious of time because I know we're kind of hitting the 45 minutes.
All right, ransomware, which we've already sort of discussed a little second to last poll. Has your organization had a data breach or attack in the past year? Yes, no, yes, but it's been more than a year. Remember the statistic as you enter your answer, 54% experienced a data breach or a cyber attack.
Thanks, good to hear. That's
wonderful. All right.
Sorry, I probably clicked close too fast. That was my bad. So let's just talk about ransomware. Again, this is, I think it's important to point out because that $1 trillion number that Scott threw out earlier, this is what started all of that revenue from coming into these cyber criminals. So what do they do? They take your data and they hold it for ransom. And how do you get your data back? Well, you pay money to these cyber criminals in the form of cryptocurrency, which and if you haven't done before, it's pretty much a nightmare to buy. I have a couple stories if you'd like to hear about them. If you can't pay the cryptocurrency or you can't access your data to get it decrypted, then you could potentially run the risk of losing it. How do you prevent the ransomware from happening? Pretty straightforward. You just need to make sure you have a comprehensive backup solution. If you think about it, whether you want to pay the ransom or not, we usually recommend not paying it because you are in fact dealing with somebody who had malicious intent from the get-go. So you just choose to lose the data that was worked on that day, delete it, purge it, move it off to the side in case you want to mess with it later, and then restore everything back using a comprehensive backup solution. The other ways to prevent it is just implement everything we talked about. Have advanced email protection, get the users aware. Have an advanced antivirus solution, have a traditional antivirus solution, set up complex passwords. If all of that's happening in the environment, your chances are pretty slim that you'll actually be attacked with ransomware. The moral of the story, I like to tell the story of this IT director that that we work with as a client. We met with our security partner. We went over all these solutions and more, and he was totally overwhelmed. It was over lunch, luckily. So at least he got some food of it, but he was totally overwhelmed with all the different solutions that we had out there. And he just asked for the silver bullet. So what can I do to just prevent everything? I'm sorry, not everything, but the majority of things from happening, because I don't want to write 17 case studies and F for approval for 20 different solutions. And email's the biggest way to prevent that. 90%, Scott had that statistic in the beginning, of all malicious attacks occur over email. So make sure your users are aware. Whether it's your own type of campaign or use some of the software we recommended, and have some email obedience, make sure you're implementing some type of advanced spam solution to protect your environment and prevent those emails from coming in just from the get-go.
All right, here's just two numbers to kind of support the moral of the story. 84% of big breaches were detected, regardless of sizes of companies. Obviously, and this is a global statistic from CIO.com, their annual research poll. So it's detectable. And the best way to prevent it, here are the numbers to support it. If there is some form of training or surely just more dialogue and encouragement to be aware when something could potentially be malicious, to take an extra step of caution, 45 to 70% of them can be prevented. So in terms of ransomware, anybody got any stories or do they have any questions on it? I find this from a psychological standpoint incredibly stimulating, but anything before I get into kind of closing data with the COVID about your needs and protections in general?
Yeah, just a quick comment on that. We got hit with the we get hit from all angles all the time, but we got hit with the gift card scam, and it was a new employee in HR. And you know, you only have we try to get them get our IT security going, you know, right away. But she had I don't even think she had gone through it yet, and you know, gets this. Somehow this email got through our filters and it's coming from, looked to be coming from the CEO and, hey, can you buy some gift cards? We're doing this. And she fell for it, but we're using Sophos.
Okay. Gotcha.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's that same IT director I was talking about earlier, I was on the phone. And somebody barged into his office and he was just kind of naturally upset just because somebody barged in and you could hear the you know, in the assistant's voice, the fear of, oh no, I think I just gave $1,000 of gift cards to somebody. Yeah. And I was like, Eric, who is it? We need to change passwords. We need to run scan. Yeah. And I promise you, you know, not even a week later, I was in front of the partners and doing something similar to this. And they just, how do we stop this? How do we prevent it? What do we do? You know, and we ended up implementing Mimecast for them, you know, not even a month later. It's hard. The impersonation is really, really hard because there's multiple layers of impersonation. And you have to, there's a challenging balance of, so, you know, if Chris has a personal email and you're emailing yourself or you have an incoming email from your personal email, that could technically be identified as an impersonation, right? Because it's not from the business email. So you want to let those go through. But if somebody else that's not Chris's actual personal email and obviously not the business emails emailing using Chris's name, then you don't want those to go through. So what we typically recommend for there is, and you guys probably do this, you just add a header on there that says, hey, this is an external email. It's not from inside your organization. And then that little flag itself kind of helps people identify, oh, I should question this. I should, you know, consider taking action before buying a gift card or clicking a link or anything.
Yeah, we have those headers and
they still did it.
They still did it. I agree with you. It's the training. Yeah. I like your number or your statistic that you threw up there. It's training and getting that training done as quickly as you possibly can when new hires are brought on board is a real challenge.
Do you guys do ethical email campaigns?
We do. Yeah, we use Cofense, their FishMe product.
Yep. Gotcha. Yep. Nice. That usually helps.
All right, guys. Last poll, last topic. As Sue pops up the final poll, and we're about to embark on what happens after the curve flattens, which I know we're all curious for many reasons of what that answer will be. How is your company's IT environment managed? Is there a managed IT provider or an MSP? Do you have internal IT staff member or members? Do you have a hybrid between this? So you have like a CIO and then your help desk or escalation is managed from a managed service provider? Or do you not see need for that right now or haven't, and you just have a part-time IT service when needed? So we got the top two. We're dealing with companies of this size. It's not a surprise. We are a managed service provider at VitalTech, but as Sean alluded to, we do work with larger companies where they do have E-level or CTO or CIO, and we're working in conjunction with them. We see our, regardless of sizes, whether it's our clients of 4 or 5 workstations or people or 700, we see them all as partners, and we try to make decisions as if it was our own budget. But all right, so once the curve flattens, what then? I know this is what we're racking our brains with, people that own companies at the corporate level. What's going to happen? Well, from a tech standpoint, Sean and I advise you to answer these questions. And in the meantime, certainly be asking yourself these questions. I think it's really healthy with anyone that you really have their ear or they bend yours to start having these discussions, because I don't think it's too preliminary. Think outside the building. Do we need the same office space? How many employees can remain working remotely, or as we call it, distributed work? If they've been doing it and no one has an issue with it, do they need to go back to the office? And then it starts asking, well, if 40% are going into remote work still, why do we need the same amount of office space? There's the big question that I think that Sean and I, talking to either our partners or prospective clients, this is the big one. Your internal IT staff has been remote now for months. They cost far more than an MSP. Could they be replaced with managed IT support and a provider for that long-term? And I can answer, I can talk about that. That's what I'm basically a sounding board for day in, day out. How should remote communication tools be implemented and sustained? I think we sort of addressed that, and it only will be accelerated. And what is the comparison in terms of sheer productivity for your business and internally with your workers and their discipline pre-COVID-19 and then amid COVID-19, right? Was the productivity better, worse, or different? Was communication worse, better, or different? So fortunately, census-wide a week ago, as I alluded to earlier, their report came out. As you'll see, these numbers sort of have a consistency to them. Roughly half of those that responded, and they were business leaders from the United States, United Kingdom, and France, which is pretty standard for them. It's about half. And that either is because they're overly cautious or they're paranoid, and likely their previous experiences have dictated why they've answered as such. 49% of companies expect a data breach or cybersecurity incident to them in the next month. And that's really the takeaway from CensusWide's independent study, is that the ransomware, the thieves that are trying to breathe down our necks for vulnerability, they're about a month away from going with a full court press. 50% of companies would consider reducing workforce staff to properly fund data protection. 56% of organizations plan to continue widespread remote working even after the pandemic ends. 53% of companies have accelerated their plans for moving all data to 100% cloud-based model. I know we talked about that earlier in terms of, are you a server, are you a cloud? That's really been sort of this gradual organic procedure where people further entrust in the cloud, and the cloud is where we're doing our storage. I think this is speeding up, accelerating the process. 51% of business leaders admit that their workforce is still not properly training to work remotely. We get it. If you can imagine Sean and his force, as the Pritzker announcement came, and from a federal standpoint, this really came rapidly. All of a sudden, everybody's like, okay, scatter. You're not going to be able to work in your office. Now you need to do the same productivity from home. Imagine the calls we were getting, or I'm sure Chris was getting. I've never worked from home, and they want me to do the same stuff as I would if I was in the office. And because they've had to sort of grapple and speed this process up, some stuff has slipped through the cracks. This might be the most telling one of them all, in my opinion. 55% of companies, their leaders would not have implemented remote working in the next 5 years if it wasn't for COVID. And that affects agnostic, regardless of industry. It's happening, whether we liked it or not, but it's been this remarkable case study globally, regardless of industry, on now, is this the new normal? So with that, We'll take any further questions, comments, feedback, anything that you still have as a chord struck. And most of all, thank you for the time.
Yeah, thank you, guys.
Thank you so much, Scott and Sean. I'm going to pause the recording. And I know that Scott and Sean are able to stay on for longer. So if you have any really specific questions to your situation that may not be a CEO level kind of question, I know that they'll welcome them.